Okay, so we left off at page 87. I'll do just a quick review. The trouble with a book like this is we so easily lose the forest for the trees. So I'm always going to try to just keep the main thread in line. Remember, we started off with what are projections, and then she shifted to what we're doing now, which is what is projected. And the problem surfaces pretty quickly that what creates projections can't merely be something personal. We know there are personal projections, but if you think how the Greeks all had a certain understanding of religion that we don't have, that cultures project. And look at the projections of the Germans onto the Jews. Nations project. So the projection is obviously something more than a personal phenomenon. Therefore, she turns to Jung's concept of the collective unconscious, which is where we are now. So projections can be part of the personal unconscious, and they also can be from the collective unconscious. So this chapter now is what is the collective unconscious? You probably know most of this, I would imagine, but it probably doesn't hurt to hear it again anyway. So a couple of things that she talked about last time. This concept of the collective unconscious is an attempt to honor the past but not identify with it. So these old forms of, say, religion or old understandings of science, that's what she did up to now, we can say are false, but it doesn't explain why we had those views in the first place. So the collective unconscious is the hypothesis to explain what we once believed, which we now know is false, still has an existence somehow, but we understand the nature of that existence differently. So we don't think Zeus literally causes lightning, but we do realize there are forces in ourselves that can create such emotions as to be as strong as a lightning strike. That's what she was saying, that the collective unconscious is a midpoint. It's not something we take as literally true. It's not something we say, oh, well, just because we don't believe in Zeus anymore, all of that stuff is wrong. It's right, just on a different level. A key idea of Jung's, as opposed to Freud's, is that we build up our ego by acts of interjection. For Freud, we throw contents of ourselves out into the world. Again, that's true somewhat for personal projections, but for collective projections, we have never been conscious of those things. And so Jung sees that over the course of history, the ego is shaped and strengthened by our withdrawing projections from each epoch. Another point that's key to Jung is he doesn't think experience causes archetypes, but that archetypes shape experience. In other words, I remember I told you the example of that one professor who said that mandalas were caused by the nipple. Child sees a red shape, a round shape, and that's the origin archetype. For Jung, no, it's the other way around. And the reasons he gives are that when you do see these images reappear in dreams, they are often changed just enough to make a statement, and that can't be explained by an introjective experience. We talked about the layers of the unconscious, anywhere from the ego to the personal unconscious, and then deeper layers of the collective unconscious that unconscious of a region, the unconscious of a nation, the unconscious of a group of nations, and so on. We'll talk then about the lowest level of the unconscious, or the deepest level, which is trans everything. It's common to everybody, namely the self. We talked about the difference between a sign and a symbol, and where we left off was that projection is the way we become conscious. For Freud, it's a defense mechanism. For Jung, it's the way that something gets down to us. And that's where we left off. All sound familiar? One thing we didn't discuss on page 85, we stopped at 86, is this business of the psychoid. It's in the second or the first big paragraph, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 lines down. We're going to hold off of that for a second. We'll talk about that later today. Psychoid's a word Jung used to designate that archetypes are not merely psychological.
And that's on 86, period.
That was on 85. So first big paragraph, 2, 4, 6, 8 lines down from the beginning of the first big paragraph. That's one of his later concepts.
And that it was what he was not.
Well, it's psychological-like is what it means. And we'll talk, I think, I'm going to hold off just a couple of pages, because she goes into the context that we can situate that idea. But it's really important. It's one of his later ideas. Just meaning that the archetype is both psychological and physical. So it's what he came up with to explain synchronicity. So we pick up now in the middle of 87 with the self. Remember, I talked about the layers: the personal, the community, the, you could say, the national, the conglomerate of nations, different layers of the collective unconscious. When I say conglomerate of nations, in other words, Islam as a whole has certain projections about us. So it's not just one nation, it's a conglomeration of nations. But at the deepest level, the collective unconscious is not culturally determined. I think you could say all of those previous forms have a cultural component to them. And all you got to do is, you know, travel and you see how different nations say the same criticisms of other nations. And if you live in that nation, you realize they're kind of like that too. I mean, for example, the Swiss talk about the Germans as being fastidious. Have you looked at your trash cans? You can eat off of them. But so that's the culturally determined aspect, or if not determined, certainly influenced. And the self is not culturally determined. That is so important here, because the self as the organizing center of the personality has a capacity, or has the capacity, to create the ordered direction of our life. It often feels like our dreams are chaotic, but in time and in retrospect, if we are working with them, we see, oh my gosh, they're leading us somewhere. And it's as if they have an intelligence. Well, they actually do have an intelligence in Jung's mind, and that intelligence resides in the self, ultimately. So what's that have to do with projection? I think this is one of the key points where Jung would differ from Freud's idea of projections as merely negative. That just as your dream images you can see evolve over time, if you're working with your projections, in other words, if you're working with your expectations of the world and your distorted judgment about the world and the kind of people that populate your life who embody those either positive or negative qualities for you, you'll see over time they change. And when you look back on it, they seem to change with an intelligence. To give a facetious, simplistic example, a girl first falls for a jock, and that doesn't work out. So she falls for a class president. That doesn't work out. And she then meets the guy she marries who is just the regular guy. And she realizes over time that when she was with the jock, she developed her own physical relationship to the world. When she was with the student council president, she became more organized and active in the emotional events of her life until she meets this guy. So that she was led through these projections into various aspects of her own development, which in retrospect form a line. So just like dream images have a secret order, Jung's point is so do projections.
So what if maybe this is irrelevant, but you can tell me. So if the girl picks worse and worse people.
Yeah.
It's like, does the self, it's a negative way of...
I would say she's probably not listening.
Okay. So she's not, she's just doing it symbolically, she's not then, like with the jock, she developed out from physical relationship, maybe she didn't take it in that way?
It could be.
Or the self is having to use harsher and harsher
That's probably the best answer.
That's what I was asking.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hit over the head with a
before finding the gift. Yeah, why in one case these errors seem to have a benevolence and other times a malevolence, like in your example, I don't know. But I think we could see behind both of them, you know, the word that you've probably heard me use is a teleology. You know that word? A goal-directedness. Yeah.
There was in here someplace that it talked about how it was hard to work with a person who had mendacity, I think. So, like, maybe it's, and I thought that meant, like, they just cling to wherever they are.
Or they're just addicted to being average.
Okay.
No urge to... to develop, really.
I can, when I looked up the word, I couldn't find it, but the word that I saw that was the most similar seemed to be like almost a pathological liar. I thought maybe it's somebody who just continuously lies to themselves.
That's too strong, I think. Mendacity is, I believe, it's simply averageness. And there's a wonderful play by Tennessee Williams. Is it? What's the name of it? I can't remember. Big Daddy.
Oh, yeah.
Or that Big Daddy's the character, and Big Daddy says, the problem here is mendacity. It's just torpor. Taking, you know, you're a frat boy, you stay a frat boy, you go in industry, you mix with your frat boys, you don't care about anybody else, That's mendacity.
Catatonic,
yes. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
I think it's Big Daddy who says that, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And do you remember the exact context?
He's talking to his son who just can't get off his path.
Oh, and he calls his, he says, your problem is mendacity. It's a beautiful word because it's kind of like ne'er-do-well, but it's like ne'er-do-anything good. It's not quite bad, but a lot of people are just on, you might say on autopilot. Not really. How can I suck the system for as much as it's worth without breaking any laws? Might be a way to put it, too. Okay. Yeah.
I had looked it up one time, too, and I do remember Lie was in there.
Oh, was it really?
So it must be...
Really? Lie in there, too?
Yeah. It must be self-deception.
Yeah.
Because, if you can't see the truth of in your, who you are and what you're doing, vis-a-vis your development, you're self-deceiving yourself, so... It must be. It's psychological.
Well, there's a dictionary to your left. See what it says.
The word I looked up was not mendacity. That was not in my little dictionary, but it was the closest one that I could find.
Mendacious, maybe.
Yeah,
that's the adjective form.
Yeah.
It is.
It was in a Jungian book somewhere. I don't know if it was in this one or. But I had to look it up. What do you think of
that really means? Yes, that's what's in here.
What's it say? Mendacious.
Lying. Untruthful. Hence, or cognate, maybe.
Okay, cognate.
And
the adverb menda.
Oh, that means it's from... it's telling you where the word came from. Well, that's funny. I didn't realize it had the dishonest connection.
Yeah, I didn't either. I thought it meant persistent or strong.
No, it definitely doesn't mean that.
Okay. I think it means, you're self-deceiving.
Maybe self-deceiving, yeah.
You can't see where
you're going. Or telling white lies. I don't think you say that.
Malicious, yeah.
It's like it's what comes out of laziness.
Yeah.
It's you just don't. It's just too hard to make the effort. To be honest.
It's sort of like the sociopath that always has an answer.
I don't think it's that strong.
Yeah, that's strong.
Problem is, it's very typical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To me, and maybe this is my own thing, I think of all the people who I work with and. We all agree that there's problems, but nobody bothers to bring them up.
Yeah.
It's just nothing's ever going to change, so why bother?
I think that's a great example of what that man.
And that's the averageness, and that's also the lie, because it would change if you tried that.
Mm-hmm.
And why most of us don't vote?
It's just that.
Yeah.
I really can't make a difference.
So,
yeah, we'll look at why projections can't be made conscious in the next chapter.
Gary, yeah. Look at the model on 80, and we were trying to locate the self.
Yeah.
Just for my little mind, would we put it between the unus mundus and the? Collective unconscious? Is it the deeper layer of the collective?
Or even maybe just...
Right on the line between the two?
Maybe, yeah.
Okay. Because it seems to have aspects of both of those. That she calls it an archetype,
mm-hmm.
and yet it is this unifying aspect to it.
That's what I wanted to ask about, the collective, the self versus the archetype of
the self.
Same.
So with E, like the unconscious of the individual, that would be more of a shadow. On the thing in E, the picture of 80, he is unconscious in the individual.
Uh-huh.
That would be kind of a
that'd be the shadow.
But the shadow and the self can be
yeah.
kind of all mixed in.
Well, this is the problem with diagrams.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So really, you could say the self is everything but F in some ways. But then it's also used as...
Well, I think the problem is if you get confused, just everything is everything. But, and it's true, I mean, we come up with these little divisions, and under certain circumstances, the ego is possessed by the self. In other circumstances, the shadow works for the self. So these are very limited descriptions.
So in some ways, these are helpful, and in other ways, they can be confused.
Very confused.
Depending on
yeah.
where they're used. Kind yeah. of like Bonfranc and the way she uses words, and they change it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because the concept really is bad and clear.
It's... We try to understand the unconscious with logic, and it can't be understood logically. That's the problem. But we have to have some sort of working grasp. So if you think of this as a working hypothesis, you're probably better off. Yeah.
And so when they used to put big capital L versus small f on self, they were Bonfranc and Jung, they were not really making, they were making the distinction between our individual consciousness versus...
I don't know either.
Okay.
The problem is, in German, all nouns are capitalized. Mm.
Really?
Yeah.
Even now?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah. In a sentence, all nouns are capitalized. So
the translation stuff.
So it's the translation that gives it a big or a small S.
Okay.
Now, I wonder what Jung would have said. I don't know. And I wonder what Bonfranc would have said. I don't know, because they certainly knew English well enough to say, well. And there's a huge debate, you might say. You know, certainly in London, these two sides hardly even talk to each other. One says it should be a small s, the other says it should be a big s.
Back
again,
the inverse. Right.
Yeah.
I
don't know what to tell you. I see the argument for both sides. I think the original argument goes, we don't like the big S because it smacks of religion. And so we want the small s to show this is a human category. And the other side would say, well, but the self is different. And we want to acknowledge that with the capital S. You could probably find people who say, well, let's use the capital S for the collective self and the small s for the personal self.
That's what I always thought it meant. But
I don't think that's necessarily accurate. It depends on who's interpreting, I think. Yeah. I guess I'd probably go more, I don't know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday I'll small s, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday I'll big s, and Sunday we'll forget about the whole thing. I didn't even notice what word they use here. They use the big S here. So I'm guessing, you know, she would have proofread this English translation before it was published.
Did she even say in here though somewhere that
there's
something about big S and small S?
I don't know if she did or not. If she does, remind me if you find it.
Well, and I was just trying to wrap that in with the other questions about this diagram. So. I didn't know
they had a big argument. Yeah. It used to be two groups in London. One was Michael Fordham. He's the guy who hates the big S. And Gerhard Adler, you know, you read his book. He was the other camp. He started the other institute. And he was the big S guy. I see both points. I mean, if you deify the self, then you don't argue with it. That's the problem with the big S. And if you make the self of the small s, that's not quite right either, because it is more powerful than the other factors of the psyche.
Maybe you could just put the first letter of self in italics or something.
More like the Jews do, you know, you can't say the word God, you just have an asterisk.
Right.
ELF.
Elf.
That works.
That works.
Yeah. Let's see, where were we before I got so excited about it?
Sorry, but I just wanted to be able to play.
Well, no,
I'm flexible about it.
It's good. I guess I go more with the big S. But, you know, I go to these dream workshops sometimes, and people just like, they just idealize the dream. I just find it so irritating that they are simply identified with the unconscious. And I want to say, no! You know, you have a right to talk back. And they're the kind of people that would see the self as God. And therefore, I think that's what's implied when you capitalize S. Take your pick.
After all, we're just the lamp looking up at this big thing.
I probably, when I'm talking to people who want to idealize the self, I'll say small s, and people who, you know, there's a whole faction in our field too that just denies that the self is anything. Hillman's group is notorious for that. There is no center of the psyche. You know, he just died, by the way.
That's what Hillman
said? Yeah. There's that Jung's problem is that the psyche is polytheistic, not monotheistic. And there's no central value.
That's why his psychology is called the psychology of archetypes.
Yeah. Archetypal psychology. Yeah. And I don't agree. That's not true either. I think the self is enormously powerful.
When those who are in the Hillman camp do dream work, they go right to the archetype. They don't even look at the personal associations to the dream at all. They just feel that they're not even valuable. We just go right to the archetype level and work it out. They do have those archetypal components, but I guess personally I feel without the individual's thoughts and feelings about those dream images,
how can
you possibly know what you're talking
it's
about?
It's pure autoeroticism.
And that's where, what was that place in California? Where,
a couple
of people I know.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Greece.
Pacific. Yeah, that's, I don't think that's all that's out there, but that's a stronghold of Hillman.
Because Marion goes out there.
Yeah, Marion goes out there and others. But certainly they are big on Hillman.
I think it would be dangerous to just do the archetype.
I think it's very dangerous.
You could get taken over by that archetype.
Yeah.
That would really inflate it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why he's so inflated.
Of course, he just died.
I know. I don't care. Well, I just had a woman come to me, not just, about a year ago, who went to one of his workshops. And, let me have told you this, and she's beautiful, doing work that blew me away. She's from Cincinnati. She is an art therapist working with schizophrenic patients in a clinical setting, in the psych hospital. I mean, this is unheard of today. First of all, the hospital would pay somebody to be an art therapist anymore, you know. These are all the jobs they get rid of. And that she could successfully work with schizophrenics in art therapy, and that the staff would, they call it triage, would assess what of the schizophrenics were amenable to art therapy and which ones weren't. And so they were cooperating with her and giving her the folks that would grow. Often what they'll do, they'll give you everybody and you fail and they say, you see, this is useless. I mean, I was so touched by her. And she then went to a workshop with Hillman, and Hillman said, what do you think is the most important thing in psychotherapy? And she raised her hand and said, to give people hope. And he just ripped her to shreds in front of the group. She came to me crying. I said, well, he's a nutcase. That's the problem. But you see the meanness. I mean, that is a very valid answer, particularly if you're working with folks who are about ready to jump off a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But it's not so much his theory, it's just these are the kind of stories I keep hearing about him, just mean, negative, nasty, and belittling. And that's the most recent. And, you know, when you see somebody doing, I mean, and she was ready to call the question in her whole work. See how selfish, how destructive that is?
Yeah.
And I just said, for God's sakes, don't listen to him. I don't listen to him, and you're doing beautiful work, and hope is very important. And continue giving your people hope. Yeah. So, and, you know, I got off on that because you said it's inflated. That's an inflation. And you're above somebody and you put him down. So.
That's a good example of just, I think we were talking the other day about patriarchy and how invasive, it's just so ubiquitous, we're so invaded with it in our culture that we cannot, you know, we can't get out of that container, kind of. And, but one of the things that's so, as a thread in it is power. You know, power is the value.
Yeah.
And relationships and discussions about, and even the question, what's the most valuable thing about it?
How do you know?
You know, even that places one thing above another. So it's just, God, it's just so everywhere. Mm-hmm.
So what we come to after she just mentions the self, and we'll be looking at this throughout the whole thing now, how underneath this projective process there is an order. And she says, so why can't this damn thing just work easily? She introduces an idea that she will pick up later, that projections and light have something in common. That is, light does not travel in a straight line. In theory, at least, if you stood on top of the earth and you shined a flashlight, that light would come eventually around, hit you in the back. The universe is curved. Light is curved. We don't see the curve because the arc is so big. For us, it's straight. But she's just giving a metaphor here and saying projections are like that. They work in an arc. Things never occur straight. Why did you have to have that relationship to get that insight? Why couldn't you just get that insight directly? That's the question she'll be asking. Because that's the nature of projections, like light. They don't work in a straight line. So we're dealing with a curved phenomenon. She'll come back to that. She just alluded to that here.
And that's on 87?
That's 87, yeah. Usually recognizes their compensatory character only later and marvels at the strange and curious byways and detours by means of which the compensatory function of the unconscious accomplishes its end. See, we'll see where that is in the middle of the page. So if you're really true to your eros, and you either get into that relationship or at least try to understand why is this person in my life now, you will often see that it has a point to it. And it's leading you to develop an aspect of yourself that you will need later.
Being asked
of
your future self.
Right. So that projections are often tied to future accomplishments.
Yeah.
and the relationship itself may not work out, but the purpose is still there. So see how Jung enlarges his whole concept of projection as defense mechanism, projection as what you do to avoid something, and so on. I think it adds dignity to all these messes we get into. She then, bottom 87 and 88, turns to another point, returning to something she discussed on page 33 and 34, that there is a double action in a projection. There is an activation of an emotion inside and a seeing of interest on the outside. And earlier she said, where does that come from? Now we have the term, it comes from the archetype, which is both image and instinct. That's something we'll be getting into in a couple of pages. An archetype has an instinctual pull and an image pull.
So you're looking at it as a line?
It's a line. Polarity. Yeah, it's a circle, but we could start by calling it a line.
Derek, yeah. The reason that the instinct side was called infrared and
image,
because it seems kind of archetypal that they use that language, so I just wondered.
Yeah, well, it's a metaphor, remember?
Yeah.
So we're sort of getting into the next big point now. For Freud, I don't say this just to knock Freud, but I think it's helpful to see where these ideas started. The big thing was instinct, sex instinct and aggression instinct. But what Jung felt was instincts also portray themselves in dreams. So you can't just say there's something like an instinct, period. The instinct also brings with it an image, so that it can represent itself. Another way of saying that is that the archetype has two poles. An image pole and an instinct pole. And a projection that occurs when an archetype is activated consists of an emotional experience and the person who evokes that emotional experience, and they belong together because they're two sides of the archetype.
And could this then lead us to the formation of a symbol out of the image?
This is the symbol.
Okay.
So, in Jung's word, the instinct has the capacity to symbolize itself. And the other thing that is implied here is, which is new, if the archetype is activated, and this is not so much in this book, but I just mention it, we usually think of getting nailed by an instinct, erotic fascination, or rabid resentment of somebody that just overtakes you. You suddenly can't stand your boss. Or you can stand, which is, we don't know which is worse. But we can also get possessed by the image side. And that is what movements are. Think of communism. That's an idea. Ideas can possess us and drive us just as much as instincts can. She doesn't get into that. I just mentioned it.
So really we're talking about two kinds. We're talking about two ways of showing the polarity.
Yes.
It can be instinct versus image, or instinct versus archetype.
Or I say instinct as an expression of the archetype.
And what does she say that? She talks about it, someone experiencing something instinctually or archetypally, and she puts those at poles. On page 9.
I don't think she means those as polarities.
It gets a little confusing on what her polarities actually are.
Yeah, well...
I think the instinct can express itself as an image, so that's
right.
Not a true polarity either, image versus instinct.
No, it's a continuum.
It's the same thing in a way.
But the,
right.
But the instinct itself can become an image.
Yes.
And the image can have an emotional component to it.
And then, or you can just have one or the other, I see.
You can just have the instinct without the instinct.
You can be assaulted by the instinct and haven't seen the image. The image. Or you can have an image and not see the instinct behind it. Communism, for example, it was an ideal so you might even say for image, apart from the archetype as an ideal, but a thought. Capitalism is the same thing. A movement which seizes the mind, and what we don't see is all the instinctual consequences of that image, of that idea. So in the name of equality, Stalin could kill millions of people. The image was communism, the instinct was murder. And the same with Hitler.
On an individual level, could we say Nietzsche was Zarathustra, first was the archetype, and he gets taken over by the image.
He gets taken over by the image.
Of it.
Yeah.
And totally disregards the instinctual aspects of what he's saying.
Right. Until he goes crazy and his instincts overran him. He was blanking his sister. You can think of the image aspect of the archetype without the instinct as what shapes the way groups of people think in a particular historical period. Why were the 60s full of liberalism and the 90s full of conservatism? Not just one person thought differently, a whole society thinks differently. But going back to the individual, these two should work as a whole. Often they don't. In other words, somebody falls in love with somebody, wham, they're caught with that. The person may be a psychopath. You say to them, but that person's a psychopath. They say, well, I don't care. It feels so good to be with them. There's no image there whatsoever. So what we try to do is build a bridge between the two. But what reason she goes into it now is, in the best case, when projection is established, the instinct emerges in the feeling that are associated with that person, and the image is that person seen outside. So the image is what is projected.
So in the case of Christiana Morgan, she was kind of caught in both image and instinct,
yeah,
because the instinctual response to whatever it's learning. Mm-hmm. And then she thought at the same time that she was moving out of Victorianism.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah, to that strong reaction, should that have produced a symbol? Did it produce a symbol for her and she just didn't see it?
He was the symbol.
He was the symbol.
And she didn't see it.
She just took it literally.
Right.
Okay. So she got really caught in that.
And this is getting a bit off projection now, but it is on the theme of instinct. This problem of the relationship between instinct and image does become more acute in periods of huge historical transition. Yeah.
I think where I'm having trouble with it is, okay, so projections are everywhere and I think I'm having trouble with this, with the idea of what activates it. I mean, in a way, what you're talking about, image, it sounds like that's where we don't realize, that it's being projected.
Mm-hmm.
But then, well, I guess that could happen. So energy can get activated, and this image gets projected, but you're not understanding that, so you don't see any think inside of it.
Yeah, and there is no reason. It just happens. That's one of Jung's points too, where for Freud this has to be caused.
Mm-hmm.
You might say for Jung these shifts can be purposed.
Yeah.
They just happen.
And but the reason is for your development.
Yeah.
That, random.
Yeah. That you don't say what's causing this. You say where is this leading me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think spontaneity is one of the key qualities he attaches to the archetype. And that we're not used to thinking like that. This is why he liked nuclear physics so much, because they say the same thing about the particles in the atom. They just move where they want to. They don't need a cause. What causes radioactive decay? It just happens. That's the way archetypes work.
Except in the longer term perspective, it is teleological,
right.
Moving towards.
But why did you meet that person today and not a year ago? There you can't pin down a cause. Or why this person and not another?
I guess it's just levels of different levels.
What do you mean?
Whether it happens on December 31st of 81 versus
mm-hmm.
91, or whether it's X or Y person. I mean, seems to me that's on one level, a literal personal level.
Yeah.
But
right.
Jung was taking it to the next level.
Right.
It's more.
In the bigger perspective, yeah, you can see there's an arrangement. Yet the way it operates daily seems to be pretty haphazard. Same way, I think really it helps to go back to physics on these stuff, because we really don't have a way of thinking about this. The decay of uranium, you've heard a Geiger counter, tick, 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 tick. It's random, absolutely random. But if you average them out, there is an exact amount of average time. But there's no, but that average doesn't affect the single event. So there is a greater picture going on, that would be the purpose, but the action of that archetype can be spontaneous.
Well, and your example of shine a flashlight,
mm-hmm.
and then eventually
mm-hmm.
it's a circle.
Mm-hmm.
We just see it as a line.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, is very helpful in terms of just seeing it. We can see it as a flashlight.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this is a new way of thinking. If you're confused,
well, Jerry, like with things like communism, where you have an image that away from the instinct, would you then find in people that are caught up in that instincts that are away from the image? I'm thinking of like generalized anxiety disorder, that is becoming a very prevalent diagnosis, but people are just afraid and they have no reason that they can come up with.
You can be sure that image will be in their dreams. Yeah.
And that is symbol equals image, or is
yes
image, like you say, if you project an image of a particular person, that's an image, but it wouldn't necessarily be a symbol at that point. You'd have to get beyond that level to you, get a symbol.
And you could say, in theory, that person's a symbol, but you can't get to it until you've lived it out. And you've been disappointed enough in what you saw them to begin asking what part of yourself you saw in them. So disappointment is what makes the shift from the thing being experienced to a symbol.
Okay, so then, okay, so you're saying that you go through the image, and then you feel the emotions of the instinct, and then you can get to the symbol.
Right. If you've been disappointed.
I mean, yeah, and if you...
Or go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if you're working with it.
Yeah, if you're very reflective. Right. Most people when they're feeling good don't reflect. I think we got through one paragraph. It may take a little longer than we thought, Dave.
Next January.
Let's have a stretch.